sense of remembering things that hadn't happened. She felt an anxious worry. She had done something wrong and drained the liquid left in the bowl. She followed flickering lights through a long, endless cave. Then, bathed in firelight, she saw the Mogurs. She felt sickened and petrified with fear. She was falling into a black abyss. Suddenly, Kreb was helping her, supporting her, easing her fears. Kreb was wise and kind. He understood the spirit world. The scene changed. With a tawny flash, the felines sprang for the aurochs and wrestled the huge reddish-brown wild cow, bawling in terror, to the ground. Ayla gasped and tried to squeeze herself into the solid rock of the tiny cave. A cave lion roared, and a gigantic paw with claws outstretched reached in and raked her left thigh with four parallel gashes.
"Your totem is the cave lion,"
the old Mogur said. It changed again. The line of fires showing the way down the corridor of a long, winding cave cast light upon beautiful, draped and flowing formations. She saw one that resembled the long, flowing tail of a horse. It turned into a dun-yellow mare who flowed into the herd. She nickered and swished her dark tail, seeming to beckon. Ayla looked to see where she was going, and was startled to see Kreb stepping out of the shadows. He motioned her on, urging her to hurry. She heard a horse whinny. The herd was galloping away toward the edge of the cliff. She was in a panic, ran after them. Her stomach churned into a knot of fear. She heard the sound of a horse screaming as it was falling over the edge, tumbling end over end, upside down. She had two sons, brothers whom no one would guess were brothers. One was tall and blond, like Jandalar. The other, older one, she knew was Dirk, though his face was in shadow. The two brothers approached each other from opposite directions in the middle of an empty, desolate, wind-blown prairie. She felt great anxiety. Something terrible was about to happen, something she had to prevent. Then, with a shock of terror, she knew one of her sons would kill the other. As they drew closer, she tried to reach them, but a thick, viscous wall held her trapped. They were almost upon each other, arms raised as though to strike. She screamed.
"Wake up, child," Mammut said. "It is only a symbol, a message."
"But one will die," she cried.
"It is not what you think, Ayla," Mammut said. "You must find the real meaning. You have the talent. Remember, the spirit world is not the same. It is reversed, upside down."
Ayla jerked when the torch dropped. She grabbed for it and picked it up before the fire died, then glanced up at the hanging pillar that looked as though it supported something, but didn't even reach the ground. It was reversed, upside down. She shivered. Then, for an instant, the pillar turned into a transparent, viscous wall. On the other side, a horse was tumbling end over end, upside down, falling off the edge of a cliff. Wolf was back, nosing at her and whining, running out, then coming back and whining again. Ayla stood up and watched the wolf, still trying to clear her head.
"What do you want, Wolf? What are you trying to tell me? Do you want me to follow you? Is that it?"
She started out of the back gallery, and when she reached the opening, she saw another torch coming down the slope into the cave. The person carrying the torch obviously saw her, too, though her torch was starting to sputter and die. She hurried, but took only a few more steps before her light went out. She stopped, then noticed that the light coming toward her was moving faster. She felt relieved. But before the person reached her, her eyes began to adjust to the dark. She could see a little by the faint light that reached the back of the large chamber from outside, and thought she could probably find her way if she had to, but she was glad someone was coming. She was surprised, however, when she saw who it was. "It's you," they both said together.
"I didn't know anyone was in here. I don't want to disturb you."
"I'm so glad to see you,"
Ayla said at the same time, then smiled.
I really am glad to see you, Brokaval. My torch died.
I noticed, he said. Why don't I walk you out? That is, if you are ready to go.
I've been in here too long, she said. I'm cold. I'll be glad to feel the sun. I should have paid attention.
It's easy to get distracted in this cave. It's so beautiful and feels so, I don't know, special, he said, holding the light high between them as they started out.
It does, doesn't it?
It must have been exciting for you to be the first one to see it. We've been on these slopes so many times, I couldn't even say all the counting words, yet no one found it until you came,
Brokaval said. Just to see it is exciting. Being the first one doesn't matter. I think it must be just as exciting for anyone the first time they see it. Have you been here before? Ayla asked.
Yes. Everyone was talking about it, so before it got dark, I got a torch and came to see it. I didn't have time to see much. The sun was going down. Just enough to make me decide to come back today,
Brokaval said. Well, I'm grateful you did, Ayla said as they started up the slope of the entranceway. I probably could have gotten out. A little light reaches back there, and Wolf would have helped me. But I can't tell you how relieved I was to see your torch coming toward me. Brokaval looked down and noticed the wolf.
Yes, I'm sure he would have. I didn't see him before. He's special, too, isn't he?
He is to me. Have you met him yet? There's a kind of formal introduction that I do with him. He understands, then, that you are a friend, Ayla said.
I'd like to be your friend,
Brokaval said. The way he said it made Ayla look at him, quickly, in her unobtrusive clan-woman way. She felt a chill and a sense of foreboding. There seemed to be more in his statement than a wish for friendship. She sensed a yearning for her, and then decided she didn't want to believe it. Why should Brokaval yearn for her? They hardly knew each other. She smiled at him, partly to cover her disquiet, as they walked out of the cave. Then let's introduce you to Wolf, she said. She took Brokaval's hand and went through the process of giving Wolf his scent in the context of her approval.
I don't think I ever told you how much I admired you that day you faced Morona down,
he said when she was through.
She can be a cruel and vicious woman. I know. I lived with her when I was growing up. We're considered cousins, far cousins, but her mother was the closest relation to my mother after she died, who could nurse a baby, so she was stuck with me. She accepted the responsibility, but she didn't like it.
I admit, I don't care much for Morona, Ayla said, but some people think she may not be able to have children. If that is true, I feel sorry for her.
I'm not sure if she can't or just doesn't want to. Some think she just makes sure that she loses it whenever she's blessed. She wouldn't make a decent mother anyway. She doesn't know how to think of anyone but herself,
Brokaval said.
Not like Lenoga. She'll be a wonderful mother.
She already is, Ayla said.
And thanks to you, there's a good chance Lorela will live, he said.
The way he was looking at her made Ayla uncomfortable again. She looked down and petted Wolf as a distraction. It's the mothers who are nursing her, not me, she said.
But no one else bothered to find out that the baby wasn't getting any milk or cared enough to get help for Lorela. I've seen how you are with Lenoga. You treat her like she's worth something.
Of course she's worth something, Ayla said. She's an admirable girl, and she's going to be a wonderful woman.
Yes, she is, but she's still part of the lowest-ranked family in the Ninth Cave,
Brokaval said.
I'd mate her and share my status with her. It doesn't do me any good anyway, but I doubt if she'd want me. I'm too old for her and too, well, no woman wants me. I do hope she finds someone worthy of her.
So do I, Brokaval. But why do you think no woman wants you? Ayla protested. I understand you have a ranking in the Ninth Cave that is near the first.
and Jondalar says that you are an excellent hunter who contributes a lot to the cave. Jondalar thinks a lot of you, Brukhaval. If I were a Zelandanyi woman looking for a likely mate, and if I weren't going to mate Jondalar, I would consider you. You have so much to offer. He watched her carefully, trying to make sure that she wasn't saying those things, just so she could twist them around in her next breath into a condescending sarcasm, the way Moroni used to do. But Ayla seemed sincere, and her feelings genuine.
"Well, you're not looking, I'm sorry to say," Brukhaval said. "But if you ever decide to start, let me know."
Then he smiled, trying to make it seem like a joke. From the first moment he saw her, Brukhaval knew she was the woman he'd always dreamed of. The trouble was, she was going to mate Jondalar. What a lucky man, he thought. But then he always was lucky. I hope he appreciates what he has, but if he doesn't, I would. I'd take her in a heartbeat if she would have me. They looked up when they heard the sound of voices and saw several people coming from the direction of the camp of the ninth cave. The two tall men, who looked so much alike, were immediately identifiable. Ayla waved and smiled at Jondalar and Dalinar. They all recognized her and waved back. The two tall young women with them couldn't have looked more different, and though they were considered cousins, it was far cousins, but they both had a close connection to Jondalar. The complex family ties of the Zelandanyi had been explained to Ayla, and she thought about their relationships as she watched them approach. Among the Zelandanyi, only children of the same woman were called brothers and sisters. Children of the same man's hearth were considered cousins, not siblings. Falara and Jondalar were sister and brother because they shared the same mother, though the men of their hearths were different. Joplea was his close cousin because although Dalinar was the man of the hearth to both of them, they had different mothers. But while a sibling relationship wasn't acknowledged, it was understood. Close cousins, especially the ones called hearth cousins, were too close to mate with each other. The last person who was with them was Etchazar, Joplea's promised. He was as distinctive in his general shape and size as the tall men were, especially to Ayla. Joplea and Etchazar would be mated during the same matrimonial as she and Jondalar, and couples who shared the same ceremony often developed strong friendships. She wished that could be true, but they lived far apart, and it was not likely. As they got closer, Ayla noticed that Joplea glanced at Jondalar now and then, and surprisingly she didn't mind. She felt an empathetic sorrow for her. She understood Joplea's melancholy. She, too, had once been promised to the wrong man. But for Joplea, there would be no last-moment reprieve. Close cousins were often raised together or lived nearby and knew they were close kin and not available to be considered for mating. But when Jondalar went to live with the man of his hearth, after the fight in which he knocked out the two front teeth of the man now known as Madraman, he was already a teenager. The daughter of Dalinar's hearth, Joplea, was a little younger, but neither had known each other while they were growing up. Dalinar was delighted to have both his hearth children together and wanted them to get to know each other. He decided that one way was to train them both in the art of flint-napping, which would give them something in common to talk about. It was, in fact, a very good idea, but he didn't know what effect the youngster who was so much like himself would have on Joplea. She had always adored the man of her hearth, and when Jondalar came, it was all too easy to transfer that overpowering love to her close cousin. Jerrica saw it, but both Dalinar and Jondalar were unaware of it. Joplea always couched her feelings about him in terms of jokes, and they, knowing that close cousins couldn't mate, took it at face value and assumed that she was only teasing. There were relatively few people in Dalinar's cave of the Lanzadanyi, and none that offered much to a beautiful and intelligent young woman. After Jondalar left on his journey, Jerrica urged Dalinar to take the Lanzadanyi cave to Zelandanyi summer meetings occasionally. They both hoped that Joplea would find someone, and a great many young men were interested in her. But she felt different and self-conscious because people stared at her, and she could find no one with whom she was as comfortable as she had been with her cousin, Jandalar. She knew that occasionally some cousins did mate, far cousins to be sure, but she chose to forget that and fantasize that on his journey Jandalar would decide that he loved her as she loved him. She knew the dream was unlikely, but she passionately hoped that some day he would come home and claim her as his one true love. Instead, he returned with Ayla. She was devastated, but she saw the love he felt for the foreign woman and knew that her dream was shattered. The one man with whom she had developed some affinity was a new member of Dalinar's cave, a man who was also stared at wherever he went, Echazar, a man of mixed spirits. Joplea was the one who helped him integrate into their cave, made him understand that he was accepted by Dalinar and the Lanzadanyi, and even helped him with his language skills. And she was the one who coaxed his story out of him. His mother had been raped by a man of the others, who also killed her mate. When she gave birth, she was cursed as a bad luck woman because her mate had been killed and her son was deformed. She left her clan ready to die, but was rescued by Andovan, an older man who had run away from a vicious leader of the Sarmunai. He had lived for a while with a Zelandanyi cave, but was not comfortable with people whose customs were so different from his own. He moved away and lived by himself until he found the clan woman and her son. Together they raised him. Echazar learned the clan language of signs from his mother, and spoken language from Andrevan, though it was a mixture of his own language and the Zelandanyi he had learned. But when he reached manhood, Andrevan died. His mother couldn't stand to live alone and succumbed to the death curse that had been imposed on her. She died shortly after Andrevan, leaving Echazar alone. The young man didn't want to live alone. He tried to return to a clan, but they thought of him as deformed and refused to accept him. And though he could speak, he was rejected by the caves as an abomination of mixed spirits. Out of desperation, he tried to kill himself, and woke up to Dalinar's smiling face, who found him injured but not dead, and brought him back to his cave. The Lanzadanyi took him in, and he idolized the tall man. But it was Joplea that he loved. She had been kind to him, talked to him, listened to him, even made him a beautiful decorated tunic for his adoption ceremony into the Lanzadanyi. He loved her so much it hurt to think about it, but he didn't think he had a chance. He had struggled with himself for a long time to get up enough courage to ask if she would be his mate, and could hardly believe it when she finally accepted. It was after her hearth cousin Jandalar returned with Ayla, both of whom he liked immediately. They didn't treat him as though he were different. Wherever Echazar went, people stared at him. The combined characteristics that he inherited from the clan and the others were not the most appealing. In height, he was as tall as an average man of the others, but he retained the powerful, barrel-chested physique, relatively short, bowed legs, and hairy body of the clan. His neck was long, and he could speak. He even had a slight chin like the others, though it receded, making it look weak. His prominent nose and heavy brow ridges with unruly eyebrows that crossed his forehead in a single line were entirely clan. His forehead was not. It rose up as straight and high as any man of the others. The combination seemed outlandish to many people, as though he didn't quite fit together, but not to Ayla. She had grown up with the clan and had consequently adopted their standard of beauty. She had always thought of herself as big and ugly. She was too tall, and her face was too bland and flat. Though she may have thought the look of the mixture was attractive, to everyone else, Echazar was extraordinarily ugly, except for his eyes. Liquid dark at night and sparkling with highlights of hazel in the sun, his large, deep brown eyes were profoundly intense, acutely compelling, and highly intelligent, and when he looked at her, they revealed his love for Joplea. Though she did not love him, Joplaya did feel a kind of kinship with Echazar and a genuine respect. Though people stared at her because of her exotic beauty, it still made her feel different, and she hated it as much as he did. She also felt comfortable with him. She could talk to him. She decided if she couldn't have the man she loved, she would mate the man who loved her, and she knew she would never find a man who loved her more than Echazar. As the group from the camp drew near, Ayla noticed Brukhaval become tense. He was staring at Echazar, and there was no friendliness in his expression. It made her aware of the similarities and the differences between them. In Echazar's case, it was his mother who had given birth to a child that was mixed. With Brukhaval, it was his grandmother. Echazar's clan characteristics were definitely more pronounced, but to her, and to everyone there, the mixture was obvious in both. Brukhaval did, however, resemble the others more than Echazar. Though she was learning to appreciate what was pleasing to the others, she still found the strong clan features attractive. She had meant it when she told Brukhaval that she couldn't understand why he thought no woman would want him. She probably would consider him if she weren't mating Jondalar, and if she were a Zelindan Yi woman. But she knew she wasn't really a Zelindan Yi woman, at least not yet, and she personally wouldn't consider Brukhaval at all. While she thought he was handsome and that he did have a lot to offer, there was something about him that disturbed her. The member of the clan that he reminded her of most was Braud, and the way he was looking at Echazar right now explained why.
"Greetings, Brukhaval," Jondalar said, walking up to the man with a smile on his face. "I think you know Dalinar, the man of my hearth, but have you met my cousin Joplaya and her promised, Echazar?"
Jondalar was prepared to do the formal introductions, and Echazar had raised his hands in readiness. But before he could begin, Brukhaval interrupted.
"I have no desire to touch a flathead," he said, putting his hands down to his sides.
Then he turned aside and stalked away. Everyone was stunned. It was Folara who finally spoke.
"How could he be so rude?" she said. "I know he blames flatheads for his mother's death. I guess I should say the clan now, but that was unforgivable. I know Mother taught Brukhaval better manners than that, if no one else did. She would be appalled."
"My mother may have been flathead or clan. You can say it any way you want, but I am neither," Echazar said. "I am Lansadanyi."
"Yes, you are," Joplaya said, reaching for his hand, "and soon we will be mated."
"We know there is clan in Brukhaval's lineage, too," Dalinar said. "It's obvious. If he can't bear to touch someone with that background, how can he stand himself?" "He can't. That's his problem," Jondalar said. "Brukhaval hates himself. He was teased a lot when he was young. Other children used to call him a flathead, and he always denied it."
"But he can't change what he is, no matter how much he denies it," Ayla said.
No one had lowered their voices, and Brukhaval had excellent hearing. He heard everything that was said. He had another characteristic of the others that the clan lacked. He cried tears. And as he walked away, tears filled his eyes. "Even her," he said to himself after Ayla's comment. "I thought she was different. I thought she meant it when she said she would consider me if Jondalar were gone. But she thinks I'm a flathead, too. She didn't mean it. She would never consider me." The more he thought about it, the more angry he became. "It's not right for her to encourage a person when she doesn't mean it. I am not a flathead. No matter what she says, no matter what any of them say, I am not a flathead." It was dark, but the sky had already changed from black to inky blue, with a hint of gold outlining the hills on the eastern horizon, when the group from the ninth cave of the Zelindanyi and the first cave of the Lansadanyi started from their camp. They used torches to make their way to the place where Jondalar had demonstrated the spear-thrower, and they were glad to see the bonfire burning in the middle of the open stretch of trampled ground that had once been a field of grass. Some hunters had already arrived. As the sky lightened, The cool morning mist rising from the river began filling the spaces between trees and brush on the periphery and mingling with the people standing around the fire. The morning chorus of birds was in full throat, trilling, chirping, twittering, and calling over the low murmur of voices, highlighting the mood of anticipation. Holding Winnie's halter rope, Ayla knelt down and put an arm around Wolf, then smiled at Jondalar, who was stroking Racer to keep him calm. She looked around in wonder. It was the largest hunting party she had ever seen. There were far too many people for her to count. She recalled that Zelandani had offered to teach her how to use the words to count larger numbers, and she decided to ask her. She would like to be able to say how many people were there milling around. Women who were about to mate did not usually participate in the pre-matrimonial hunt. There were usually certain restrictions and various other activities planned for them. The first did a cursory run-through with her so she could be excused. This hunt was going to be a test of using horses and trying out Jondalar's spear-thrower, and they wanted her. Ayla was glad that she had been allowed to join the hunt in spite of her upcoming matrimonial. She had always enjoyed hunting. If she hadn't learned to hunt when she lived alone in her valley, she might not have survived, and it had given her a certain sense of self-reliance. Though several of the women who were to be mated had hunted, only one of them cared about joining the hunt. Since an exception had been made for Ayla, she was also allowed to join them. When they were young, most girls loved to go hunting just like the boys. After they reached puberty, many of them still hunted, mostly because that's where the boys were. Several enjoyed hunting for itself, but once young women mated and began to have children, most were so busy they were happy to let the men do it. That was when they began to develop other crafts and skills that added to their status and ability to trade and bargain for things they wanted, and that wouldn't take them so far away from their children. But women who had hunted in their youth were looked upon as favorable mates. They could understand the challenges of the hunt, appreciate the successes, and sympathize with the failures of their mates. Ayla had gone to the search ceremony arranged by the Zelandania the evening before, along with most of the leaders and some hunters, but she had only observed, not participated. Through the search, it was determined that a large herd of aurochs were congregated in a nearby valley that was particularly good for hunting, and they planned to try there first, but nothing was guaranteed. Even though a Zelandani might metaphysically see animals during a search, they might not still be where they were seen the next day. But the valley held a good meadow that attracted the wild cattle, and if the aurochs were gone, it was likely some other animals would be there. The hunters hoped to find aurochs, however, because the cattle were massing together in larger herds this time of year, and they provided tasty meat in very big packages. When the food he thrived on was in abundance, a full-grown bull aurochs grew to 6 feet 6 inches at the shoulder and weighed nearly 3,000 pounds, 2.5 feet taller and more than twice the weight of his largest domesticated descendant. He looked like an ordinary bull, but was so much bigger he approached the size of a mammoth. The food preferred by aurochs was grass, fresh green grass, not mature stalks, and not tree leaves. They favored clearings, edges of forests, meadows, and marshes rather than steppes. Although they would eat acorns and nuts in the fall, as well as grass seeds to build up a reserve of fat, and in winter's hungry time they wouldn't disdain browsing on leaves and buds. The bull's coat was usually black and long, with a light stripe down his back. He had a tight knot of curly hair on his forehead and 2 long, rather thin horns, whitish-gray shading into black, forward-pointing tips. Cows were smaller and shorter, and their coats tended to be lighter in color, often with a reddish tone. Usually, only the old or the very young fell to four-legged predators. The bull in his prime was unafraid of any hunter, including humans, and didn't bother to avoid them. Especially during the fall rutting season, but not limited to then, he was ready to fight and could charge in an uncontrolled rage, pick up a man or a wolf with his horns, and toss him in the air, and would gore and often disembowel even a cave lion. Aurochs were fast, strong, agile, and very dangerous. The horde of hunters started out as soon as it was light enough to see. Walking fast, they sighted the herd of aurochs before the sun was very high. The valley was surprisingly close. One end of it led to a fairly large canyon that funneled to a narrow defile, then opened out again into a natural corral. It wasn't completely blind. It had a few narrow outlets, but the place had been used before, though generally no more than once per season. The smell of blood from a major hunt tended to keep animals away until the snows of winter washed it clean again. But in anticipation of future use, fencing had been constructed across the outlets, and several of the hunters circled around to check on them and choose a vantage point from which to throw their spears. A wolf howl, not too bad an impression, Ayla thought, was the signal that all was ready. She had been warned, and kept her arm around Wolf to restrain him in case he was tempted to respond. The loud caw of a crow was the return signal. The rest of the hunters had been edging around the herd, trying not to disturb it too much, a difficult task with so many people. Ayla and Jandalar had stayed quite a way back, not wanting the scent of the wolf to precipitate anything. They mounted the horses at the signal and started forward at a gallop, Wolf running alongside. As fast and powerful as a bull could be, aurochs were still herd animals, and there were young among them. The sound of whoops and yells and the sight of unknown things being flapped at them was enough to spook them, and when one started running, others soon followed. With two humans on horseback getting surprisingly close with their flapping and shouting, and the scent of wolf, the herd was soon stampeding blindly into the canyon. The narrow constriction slowed them down as they piled up behind it trying to get through. Amidst the dust of the bawling, bellowing, roaring herd, some of them tried to break out and go another way, any other way. The people and the horses and the wolf were everywhere, turning them back. But finally, one determined old bull had had enough. He stood his ground, pawed the earth, lowered his horns, and was hit with two swift spears cast from spear throwers. He dropped to his knees, then tumbled to his side. By then, most were through, and the fence was closed. Then the slaughter began. Spears of every description were flung at the trapped beasts, flint-tipped, sharpened bone, or ivory-tipped, long and short. The hunters had to rotate behind the narrow gates that protected them from massive horns and sharp hooves. Some were hurled with spear-throwers, not just from Ayla's and Jandalar's spear-throwers. A few adventurous souls had been practicing and tried them out, here, where a few misses wouldn't hurt because the aurochs weren't going anywhere except back to the breast of the great Mother Earth in the world of the spirits. In one morning, enough meat had been secured to last the entire summer meeting for some time, and for a large matrimonial feast besides. A messenger was sent back to the camp when the aurochs were in the trap, and a second large party left to help, and by the time the last animal was down, they rushed in to begin the butchering and preserving and storing. There were several means of storage. Because of the closeness of the glaciers and the permanently frozen layer that existed at variable depths below the surface, the underlying permafrost could be utilized as ice cellars to store fresh meat simply by digging holes in the ground. Fresh meat could also be stored in deep ponds or lakes or the quiet backwaters of streams or rivers. Weighted down with rocks and marked with long poles so it could be found and recovered later, meat could last a year with surprisingly little deterioration. Meat could also be dried to last several years. The problem with drying was that early summer was the season of blowflies, which could quickly spoil meat that was set out to dry in the sun and wind. Very smoky fires would keep off the worst of the insects, but it required constant supervision and monitoring in an unpleasantly smoky environment. It was necessary, however, to dry some of the meat for traveling food. In addition to the meat, hides were extremely important. They were used for many things, from implements and containers to clothing and shelters. Fat would be rendered for heat and light and sustenance, hair for fibers and stuffing and warm clothing, tendons for sinew to make cordage and lashings for various constructions. Horns would be used to make containers, various devices such as hinges on panels, and even jewelry. Teeth were used as often for jewelry as they were for tools. Intestines could be made into waterproof coverings and clothing, and casings for sausage and fat. Bones had many uses. They could be made into utensils and plates, carvings and weapons, cracked for their nutritious marrow, or burned in hearths for fuel. Nothing would be wasted. Even the hooves and scraps of hide would be boiled for glues and adhesives, which had many uses. In combination with sinew, for example, it would help attach points to spears, handles to knives, and join composite spear shafts. It would also be used to join tough soles to softer foot coverings. But first the animals had to be skinned, the parts separated out, and the meat stored, and it had to be done quickly. Guards were posted to keep away the thieves, the other carnivores more than willing to share in the kill by whatever means they could. Such a large concentration of slaughtered aurochs brought every other meat-eating animal in the vicinity. The slinking hyenas were the first ones Ayla saw. She had her sling out and, almost without thinking, signaled Winnie to go after the pack. She had to dismount and get more stones, but the speed with which she dispatched them was reason enough to make both her and Jondalar guards. Almost anyone could butcher, even youngsters helped, but keeping away the carnivores took some effort and skill with weaponry. The pack of wolves caught Wolf's attention. He was eager to drive off interlopers from the kill of his pack, but Ayla backed him up. The vicious, aggressive wolverines were worse. Two of them, probably male and female, together because it was their season, sprayed one cow with their musk glands. It smelled so bad that after they retrieved the spear to give credit to the hunter, several people hauled it off to let the wolverines fight over it between themselves and any other carnivore that wanted to try for it. No easy task, since wolverines were known to defend their kills against lions. Ayla saw stoats, summer brown now, though come winter they would become ermines, entirely white weasels except for the black tips of their tails. She saw foxes and lynxes and a spotted snow leopard, and at the periphery, casually observing it all, a pride of cave lions, the first she'd seen since she arrived. She paused to observe them. All cave lions were pale in color, usually light ivory, but these were almost white. At first she thought they were all females, but the behavior of one made her look twice. It was a male without a mane. When she asked Jondalar, he told her that cave lions in this region did not have manes. He'd been surprised by the eastern lions that did, though they were rather scraggly. The skies above held their share of marauding meat-eaters waiting their chance to land or being chased away and flying off again. Vultures and eagles, expending little energy, floated on thermals, rising currents of warm air that supported their large outstretched wings. Kites and hawks and lammergeiers soared and dove, sometimes fighting with stately ravens and raucous crows. It was easier for small rodents and reptiles to scurry or slither in and hide from the humans, but the small predators were often prey themselves. Eventually, it would all be cleaned up by the smallest of them, the insects. But no matter how diligent the guards, all the meat-eaters would get a share before the aurochs could be completely butchered and stored, and though it wasn't their primary goal, they didn't mind that before they were through, they managed to secure a few distinctive furs as well. A successful first hunt of the summer meeting was a lucky sign. It assured a good year for the Zelandanyi and was considered especially fortunate for the couples who were about to be mated. The mating day would take place as soon as the meat and other products were brought back to camp and stashed so they would not spoil or be stolen by four-legged carnivores. Once the excitement and work of the hunt were over, the attention of the summer meeting camp turned to the upcoming nuptials. Ayla could hardly wait, but she was also nervous. Jandalar felt the same way. They caught themselves looking at each other often, smiled almost shyly, and hoped that everything would go well. Chapter 30 Zelandani tried to find a time to speak with Ayla privately about the medicine that would prevent conception, but something always seemed to interfere. There were demands on Ayla's time as well as hers. Because this was a community hunt that represented the entire Zelandani, the first had to hold special ceremonies to make sure that the spirit of the aurochs would be appeased, and major rituals to thank the Great Mother for the lives of all the animals who had sacrificed themselves so that the Zelandani could live. The hunt was almost too successful, and it took longer than usual to accomplish everything that needed to be done. The meat was cut and the fat rendered and portioned out. Hides were either scraped and dried or rolled and stored in the underground ice cellars, along with meat, bones, and other parts. And most people helped, including the women who were to be mated. Mating could wait. The first resigned herself to the delay, but she wished she had taken the time to talk with Ayla in more depth before they left the ninth cave, when it would have been easier to study the stranger and learn more about her. Who would have guessed that the young woman, at 19, still young, though Ayla seemed to think she was ancient, would possess so much knowledge? She had seemed so guileless, it made her seem inexperienced somehow. But Zelandani was coming to understand that there was far more to Ayla than she realized. She knew that it was never wise to underestimate an unknown element, but she had not followed her own counsel. And now the first was busy with another matter. The Zelandania decided to conduct first rites before the matrimonial, though generally it was afterwards, for a very specific reason. Before their first rites, all females were considered girls and were not supposed to share the mother's gift of pleasures. The rites of first pleasures was the ceremony where, under strict and careful supervision, girls were physically opened and became able to receive the spirits that would start a new life. Not until then were they fully women. But first rites were always held during the summer meetings, and usually there was some period of time after their first moon time and before their first rites when girls were in a kind of limbo. It was during this time that men found them incredibly appealing, probably because they were forbidden. There was always a second ceremony at the end of the summer meeting for the girls who started their bleeding during the summer, but the long interval in between meetings was difficult. Young men, and some not so young, were constantly after the pubescent girls, and festivals to honor the mother during the year made the young women more aware of their own urges, especially those who reached menarche in autumn. No mother ever wanted her daughter to start her moon times then with a whole winter of darkness and reduced outdoor activity ahead of her. Though a stigma of shame was placed on those who did not wait until they had their first rites, some girls, inevitably, did succumb to the persistent blandishments. But no matter how relentless the pressure, by yielding to it, the girls became ultimately less desirable as mates, because it indicated a lack of sufficient self-control. To some, it seemed ultimately unfair to stigmatize a woman because as a girl she made what might have seemed at the time to be a naive transgression of accepted custom. But there were those who considered it to be an important test of basic character, of their inherent integrity, fortitude, and perseverance, which were considered important traits in women. Mothers inevitably enlisted the aid of the Zelandania to try to conceal the indiscretion, and first rites were conducted in any case, because a young woman could not be mated without them. The Zelandania always tried to make sure that the men selected to open the young women who were already open would be discreet, so nothing would be divulged. But those who had yielded were known, not least to the Zelandania, who were among those who privately believed the test to be revealing, and were at least suspected by many others. This summer, however, a rare problem had arisen. One young woman, Janita of the south holding of the 29th cave, who had not yet had her first rites, was pregnant, and she wanted to mate the young man who had prematurely opened her. Peridol, also of the south holding of the 29th cave, was not as anxious to mate her, though he had been inordinately persistent in pursuing her throughout the winter and had made extravagant promises. Reflection Rock was so huge, with so many levels, it was too easy to find secluded places for their trysts. In his favor, it was said that Peridol was quite young. He wasn't sure he wanted to get mated yet, and his mother was not eager for her son to make such a commitment, particularly with a girl who had yielded. But the Zelandanya were using all their persuasive pressure to encourage them to agree. While it was not essential for a woman to be mated when she gave birth, it was preferable for a child to be born to the hearth of some man, especially the first child. The other side of the issue was that, generally, if a woman became pregnant before she was mated, she became more desirable because she had already proven that she was capable of bringing children to a man's hearth. But the stigma of shame for not showing enough restraint to wait until first rites was strong. Janita and her mother knew it, but they also knew that if Janita was already blessed when she mated, it was considered lucky, and she ought to be looked upon with favor. They hoped that one would compensate for the other. Many people were talking about the girl, some feeling one way and some the other, but most agreed that it was an interesting situation, particularly the approach that was taken by Janita and her mother. Those who took the side of Peridol and his mother felt that he was too young to assume the responsibilities of mating. Others felt that if the mother had indeed chosen his spirit to bless the girl, then she must feel that he was capable of being a man of the hearth. And in spite of her lack of restraint, perhaps Janita was lucky, and Peridol should be glad to mate her. A few men were even considering the idea of mating her themselves, shame or not, if the boy didn't want to. She must indeed be favored among the blessed of Donny if she became pregnant so quickly. The young women who were preparing for their rites of first pleasures were all housed in a special guarded lodge near the Zelandanya Lodge. It was decided that the young pregnant woman should stay with the other girls and go through the full ceremony, since she had to have first rites before she could be mated anyway. It was felt that she needed to be taught what young women needed to know, but when she was moved in with the others, some of them objected. "The rites of first pleasures is a ceremony to open a girl to make her a woman. If she's already open, why is Janita here? It's supposed to be for girls who wait, not girls who cheat," one of them said in a voice loud enough for all to hear. Several agreed with her, but not all. One of them countered, "She's here because she wants to get mated at the first matrimonial, and a girl can't get mated until she's had first rites. And besides, the mother has blessed her." Others, some of whom had started their moon times not long after the previous summer meeting and were rumored to have experimented with some private opening rites themselves, tried to be more welcoming, but most felt a need to be careful. They knew their good names were likely to be dependent on the discretion of the man who was chosen for them, and he could be related to one of the girls who had waited. They didn't want to offend anyone. They were more than aware that they could suffer a similar shame, and they were seeing the problems it could cause. Janita smiled at the one who spoke up for her, but said nothing. She felt a little older and wiser than most of the girls in the lodge. At least she knew what to expect, not like the ones who waited and were both eager and worried. And she was gaining some courage for having faced up to all her detractors. Besides, she was pregnant, blessed by Donny, no matter what anyone said, and she was at the stage in her pregnancy when she was awash with optimistic feelings. She didn't know that certain hormones in her body had been activated by her pregnancy. She only knew she was happy to be having a baby and feeling content. Although the girls were supposed to be in seclusion and well guarded, somehow the comments that had been made when Janita joined them, especially the phrase that first rites were supposed to be for girls who wait, not girls who cheat, were reported all through the camp. When the first heard about it, she was furious. It had to be one of their own, the Zelandanya, who had spread the word. No one else could have been that close, and she wished she knew who it was. Ayla and Jandalar had been working on aurochs hides most of the day, first scraping off the fat and membranes from the inside and the hair on the outside with flint scrapers, then soaking them in a solution of the cow's brains that had been worked by hand into a puree and mixed with water, which gave the hides an amazingly soft elasticity. Then it was rolled up and twisted to squeeze as much liquid as possible out of the hides, often using two people, one at each end. Small holes were then pierced all around the edge, about 3 inches apart. A rectangular frame that was larger than the full hide had been constructed out of four poles, and the wet skin was attached to the frame with a cord tied through each hole and pulled tight. Then the hard work began. With the frame anchored securely, resting against trees or a horizontal beam, the hides were straked. A pole with a flattened but rounded end was used to poke the hides as far as they would stretch, up and down, side to side, over and over, until after half a day of work, the hide was finally dry. At that stage, it was nearly white, with a soft and supple suede finish. It could have been made into something and worn, but if it got wet again, it would have to be straked all over again, or it would dry into hard rawhide. In order for the hide to retain its pliable, velvety texture, even after washing, it had to go through another process. There were several choices, depending on what finished product was wanted. The simplest was to smoke it. One method was to use a small, conical traveling tent, block the smoke hole, and build a smoky fire inside. Several hides could be hung near the top and the entrance fastened shut. As the smoke filled the tent and enveloped the hides, it coated each of the collagen fibers within the skin. After smoking, even if it got wet or was washed, the leather stayed supple. Smoking also changed the color of the hide, and depending on the type of wood used, it could range from shades of yellow through tan and taupe to deep brown. Another process was to mix powdered red ochre with tallow, fat rendered in simmering water, and rub the mixture into the hide. It not only gave the leather a red color, which could vary in shade from bright orangey red to deep maroon, it also acted as a water repellent. A smooth stick or bone could be used to rub the fatty substance in, crushing the surface, burnishing it to a harder, shiny finish, making it almost waterproof. Red ochre inhibited bacterial decay and was also an insect repellent, including the small parasitic insects that lived on warm-blooded animals, like humans. Yet another process, not as well known and requiring more work, was to make the almost white natural color of the hide pure white. It was somewhat prone to failure because it was difficult to keep the hide supple, but it was stunning when successful. Ayla had learned the process from Crozy, an old Mamutoi woman. It started with saving her urine, then letting it stand until through natural chemical processes it became ammonia, which was a bleaching agent. After scraping, the hide was soaked in ammonia, then washed with saponifying roots that made a soapy lather, then softened with the brain mixture and burnished with dried powdered kaolin, a fine white clay mixed in very pure tallow. Ayla had made only one white garment, and Crozy had helped her, but she had noticed a load of kaolin not far from the third cave and thought she might try it again. She wondered if the lather she had learned to make from the Los Adunai out of fat and wood ashes would work better than soap root. While she was working, Ayla heard some of the discussions about Janita and found the situation interesting because it was a fascinating insight into the traditions and customs of the Zelandanyi. There was no doubt in her mind that Peridol had started the baby growing inside Janita, since both of them had indicated that no other man had penetrated her, and Ayla was convinced it was the essences of men's organs that started pregnancy. But as they were walking back to the camp of the ninth cave, Tired after a day of working hides, she asked Jondalar about the Zelandanyi insistence on first rights before women were free to make their own choices.
I don't understand what difference it makes whether the young man opened her last winter or another man opens her here, so long as she wasn't forced,
Ayla said.
It's not like Medinia of the Los Adunai, who was forced by that band of young men before her first rites. Janida is a little young to be pregnant, but so was I, and I didn't even know what first rites were until you showed me.
Jondalar felt a great deal of empathy and compassion for the young woman. He had broken the accepted traditions of his people during his initiation into manhood by falling in love and wanting to mate his Danyi woman. When he found out that Madraman, had been eavesdropping on them, that he had actually hidden and watched them, then told everyone that they planned to mate, Jondalar went into a rage and hit him repeatedly, breaking his teeth. Madraman had also wanted Zolina for his Danyi woman. Everyone did, but she chose Jondalar and never Madraman. Jondalar thought he understood why Ayla felt the way she did. She wasn't born here and didn't quite appreciate how the Zelandanyi felt about the customs they had lived with all their lives, or how difficult it could be to go against the traditions you knew. He didn't fully understand that she had broken clan traditions and had paid dire consequences. She nearly died for it, but she no longer feared to question anyone's traditions.
People can be more tolerant of those who come from another place,
Jondalar said.
But Janida knew what was expected. I hope the young man does join with her and that they will be happy together. But even if he doesn't, I hear there are some men who would gladly mate her.
I should think so. She's a young, attractive woman who is going to have a baby that she can bring to a man's heart, if he's worthy of her,
Ayla said. They walked in silence for a pace. Then Jondalar said,
I think this summer meeting's matrimonial will be remembered for a long time. There's Janida and Peridol, who will probably be among the youngest to ever mate if they decide to do it, even without her early pregnancy. And I've just come back from a long journey, and you come from a great distance away, so people will talk about that. But I don't think anyone here understands how far it really was. Then there's Joplea and Echazar. They both have a background and kinship line unlike anyone else's. I just hope that those few people who object don't make it troublesome. I could hardly believe what Brukaval did. I thought he had more manners than that, in spite of how he feels.
Echazar was right when he said he isn't clan, Ayla said. His mother was, but he wasn't raised by them. Even if they had taken him back, I think he would have found it difficult to live with them. He knows their signs, more or less, but he doesn't even know that he's using women's signs.
Women's signs? You never mentioned anything about that before,
Jondalar said.
It's subtle, but there is a difference. The first signs that all babies learn are from their mothers, but when they get older, the girls stay with their mothers and continue to learn from them. The boys start doing more with the men and begin to learn their ways,
Ayla said.
What did you teach me and the lion camp?
Jondalar said.
Ayla smiled. Baby talk,
she said.
You mean, when I was talking to Guban, I was talking baby talk?
Jondalar said, appalled.
Even less than that, to be honest. But he understood. Just the fact that you knew something, that you tried to speak the correct way, impressed him,
Ayla said.
The correct way? Guban thought his way was the correct way to talk?
Jondalar said.
Of course. Don't you?
I suppose so,
he said. Then smiled.
What do you think is the correct way?
The correct way is always whatever way you're used to. Right now, the clan way, Mamutoi, and Zelandanyi are all correct. But after a while, when all I have spoken is Zelandanyi for a long time, I will no doubt think that is the correct way, even if I don't speak it correctly, and I probably never will. The only one I will ever know perfectly is the clan language,
but only of the clan I grew up with, and that's not quite the same as the way they do it around here," Ayla said. As they reached the small stream, Ayla noticed the sun was going down and was caught up again by a glorious blaze of color in the sky. They both stopped to watch for a while.
"Zelandani asked me if I wanted to be chosen for first rites tomorrow, probably for Janita,"
Jondalar said.
"She told you that?"
Ayla said. "Marthona said the men are never told who they will be with, and they are never supposed to tell."
"She didn't exactly tell me. She said she wanted someone who would be not only discreet but caring. She said she knew you were pregnant, and she thought I would know how to treat someone who might need the same kind of concern. Who else could it be?" he said.
"Are you going to do it?"
Ayla said.
"I thought about it. There was a time when I would have been more than willing, eager, but I said I didn't think so," he said.
"Why?" she asked.
"Because of you," he said.
"Me? Did you think I would object?"
"Would you?"
"I understand it is a custom of your people and other men who are mated do it,"
Ayla said.
"And you'd agree to it whether you liked it or not, wouldn't you?"
"I suppose," she said.
"The reason I declined wasn't because I thought you would object, although I probably wouldn't like it if you decided to become a Danyu woman for a season. It's because I don't think I could give her the attention she deserves. I'd be thinking about you, comparing her to you, and that would be unfair to her. I've always had more size than many, and I'd be withholding and trying to be careful and gentle so I wouldn't hurt her, and wishing all the time I was with you instead," he said. "I don't mind being caring and gentle, but we fit together. I don't have to worry about hurting you, at least not now. As you get further along, I don't know, but we can work something out then."
She hadn't realized how pleased she would be that he had refused. She had heard how attractive most men found those young women, and she wondered if she was feeling jealous. She didn't want to be. She had heard what Zelandani said at the women's meeting, and she would not have objected if he had accepted the offer. But she was happy that he had not. Ayla couldn't help but smile, a big radiant smile that almost matched the sunset, which gave Jondalar a warm glow. All the couples who were to be mated met with the Zelandanya the day following the rites of first pleasures ceremony. Most were young, but some were middle-aged and a few were quite old, well over 50 years. Regardless of age, they were excited and looking forward to the event, and most were friendly to each other, the start of the special bond between people who were mated at the same mating ceremonial. Many lifelong friendships were established then. Ayla left Wolf with Marthona, who said she would be willing to stay with him, although Ayla had to tie him down with a restraining rope to keep him from following her. Before she left, she noticed that Marthona was indeed a calming influence, and he seemed more relaxed when she was with him. When they arrived at the Zelandanya Lodge, Ayla saw Lavila and a man she had not met. Lavila waved them over and introduced everyone to Jondakam, a man of medium height with a red beard, a pleasant smile, and mischievous eyes.
"So you're from Elder Hearth," Jondalar said. "Kimaran and I are old friends. We got our manhood belts together. I saw him during the bison hunt. I didn't realize he had become the leader of the second cave."
"He's my uncle, my mother's younger brother," Jondakam said.
"Uncle? You seem closer to age mates," Ayla said.
"He's only a few years older than I am, more like an older brother. My mother was about the age of a girl during first rites when her brother was born," Jondakam said. "She was always like a second mother to him, even then. When his mother, my grandmother, died, my mother took care of him. She was pretty young when she mated, but her mate died early. I'm her firstborn, and I have a younger sister, but I hardly remember the man of my hearth. She was called to the Zelandanya and didn't mate again."
"I remember embarrassing myself," Jondalar said. "I saw Kimaran's mother and made some typical comment about the young attractive woman standing with the mothers and wondering what baby was completing his manhood rites."
He smiled.
You can imagine how I felt when he said she was there for him. He was as big as I was. Then he told me she was actually his sister. After they had been there for a while, and it appeared that the Zelandanya were getting ready to begin, two more people arrived, the youngsters, Janita and Peridol. The couple stood at the entrance looking nervous and a little scared, and for a moment seemed ready to bolt. Suddenly, Lavila left the group and walked quickly toward them.
"Greetings! I am Lavila of the West Holding of the 29th Cave. You are Janita and Peridol, aren't you? I think I met you, Janita, when you came to harvest pine nuts at summer camp a year or two ago. I'm with Ayla and Jandalar. She's the one with the animals, and he's the brother of my sister's mate. Come and meet them," she said, and started leading them back. They seemed at a loss for words.
"She is Proliva's sister, isn't she?" Joplea said quietly. "Yes, I can see Proliva welcoming someone like that," Ayla said.
Joplea and Echizar are here, too. They're the Lanzadanyi couple who came to be mated with us," Lavila was saying as they approached. "And here's my promised, Jondakam of the second cave of the Zelandanyi. Meet Janita and Peridol, both of the south holding of the 29th cave."
Looking at the young couple.
"That's right, isn't it?"
"Yes,"
Janita said, smiling nervously and frowning worriedly at the same time. Jondakam held out his hands to Peridol.
"Greetings," he said with a broad smile.
"Greetings," Peridol responded, taking his hands, though his grip was rather limp, and he didn't seem to know what else to say.
"Greetings, Peridol,"
Jondalar said in turn, also holding out his hands.
"Did I see you at the hunt?"
"I was there," the young man said. "I saw you on a horse."
"Yes, and Ayla too, I imagine."
Peridol looked uncomfortable and at a loss for words.
"Did you have much luck?" Jondakam asked.
"Yes," Peridol said.
"He killed two cows," Janita said for him, "and one had a calf inside."
"Did you know the skin of that calf will make wonderful baby clothes?" Lavila said. "It's so fine and soft."
"That's what my mother said," Janita replied.
"We haven't met," Ayla said. She held out both hands.
"I am Ayla, formerly of the lion camp of the Mamutoi, but now of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi. In the name of the great earth mother, Mut, also known as Dani, I greet you."
Janita was a little shocked. She had never heard anyone speak so differently. There was a rather uncomfortable silence for a moment. Then, as though remembering her manners, she said,
"I am Janita of the south holding of the 29th cave of the Zelandanyi. In the name of Dani, I greet you, Ayla of the 9th cave of the Zelandanyi."
Joplea then stepped forward and held out her hands to the young woman.
"I am Joplea of the 1st cave of the Lanzadanyi, daughter of the hearth of Dalinar, founder and leader of the Lanzadanyi. In the name of the Great Mother, I greet you, Janita. This is my promised, Echizar of the 1st cave of the Lanzadanyi."
Janita looked directly at the couple, her mouth literally hanging open as she stared. She was not the first to look surprised, but she seemed less able to control it than most. Then, as though she suddenly realized what she was doing, she closed her mouth and flushed deep red.
I am sorry. My mother would be so angry if she knew how rude I was, but I couldn't help it. You both look so different, but you are beautiful and he is not,"
she said, then flushed again.
"I'm sorry. I mean, I didn't mean that. I just...
"What you mean is she's so beautiful and he's so ugly," Jondakam said with a twinkle in his eye.
He looked at them both and grinned.
"It is true, isn't it?"
There was a moment of awkwardness.